that you received in your little packet, you might turn to the pages that are not numbered, but Roman numeral 2. What are the effects of our problem? We have 4 points in our outline for the day. We've covered just the first one in the morning. What is our problem? We talked about something wrong. We live by code. And something missing, the effects of fatherhood and brotherhood. And now we want to look for a few minutes at how does this show itself? What's the evidence that really something is wrong with us as men? And after we take a look at that, we'll look at the causes of what's wrong with us. And then we'll conclude our afternoon by thinking about what we can do about it. What are some of the solutions? Roman numeral 2, what are the effects of our problem? In your outline, I have the phrase unresolved living. A phrase that I think I prefer since I wrote the outline is unconnected living. Unconnected living. That'll be clear a little bit as to why I prefer that phrase, but just for now, you might want to mark it down. Unconnected living. The first thing to say about this second subject, what are the effects of our problem, is that the lack of fatherhood and brotherhood does make it difficult for us to find the courage to create when there's no code. In the absence of a father who believes in us and has given us the injection of life, in the absence of a brother who hears and struggles along with us, it's really difficult to believe deeply that there is the substance within that could be shaped in a direction that, when given, will make a desired impact. And when we lack the courage to create, when we lack the courage to move into a situation where we have no code and where we're unsure of ourselves, when we lack that courage, when we live non-courageous, uncreative lives, something inside of us dies. Something that was intended to be alive dies. There have been many times when I've faced situations not unlike what I mentioned this morning in regard to my wife, and I didn't move toward her. There was no movement to deal with. There was rather an angry interchange or a self-contemptuous interchange or a sullen retreat. And when that happens, something inside of you dies, but it yearns to come alive. And when that something dies and yearns to come alive, what I want to suggest is that we're far more vulnerable to inappropriate ways of finding life. We're far more vulnerable to when we flick through the TV channels and we have cable and we come to something that really we have no business watching. It's harder to turn to the next channel. We want to stay and look at that because somehow it brings something to our souls that seems to be empty. When we fail to speak into the chaos of our lives, a void is felt that demands relief. And when that void is felt, that void is a very, very painful void. It's a void that requires being filled. That void that comes when we fail to move into our worlds with creative courage is a void that literally screams. And I believe we have, in what I'm talking about now, the roots of the addictive process. The roots of sexual addiction, the roots of drug addiction, alcoholic addiction, addiction to work, addiction to ministry, all the addictions that we speak about in our modern culture, I think have their roots in a void within my soul that I experience as very badly empty because I failed to have the courage to create. And that pain of emptiness is experienced within me as a compulsive drive. Do you all know what that phrase means? And not just in terms of definition, but in terms of your own life. If you were taking the microphone, could you all give some illustrations of where you felt just compulsively controlled by something? Where there's a temptation and you simply did not have the power to resist. Where there was something that you know you really ought not to be doing, your conscience spoke against it, but there was just no power to resist doing this particular behavior at all. The pain of emptiness is felt as a compulsive drive, and I think it's a compulsive drive that maybe works in two directions. A drive to, number one, find something that works. Some system of living, something to do that gives me power, and that expresses my frustration and my anger. I've got to find something that works, something that when I move out of me into the world, that internal void is somehow relieved. I'm not courageously creating, but I found something that when I do this, at least it works in some form, and it may be rape. Or it may be compulsively working 70 hours a week. It may be drugs or crime, or it may be devoting more time to ministry. It may be relating to people in an intimidating way, or in a helpless way. How many of you know what I mean when I say that a lot of times with people, we act in certain helpless kinds of ways, determined to get a certain response from them? You know what that means, don't you? Where there's a certain kind of way of relating, and all of us have a style of relating that has an agenda. We're doing something to have an effect on other people. I know what it is in certain circles to intimidate others. I know what it is in certain circles to pull responses from others by expressing a lack of confidence in myself. I know how to pull for compliments. I know how to interact in a way with people that gets the response from them that I want. I found certain codes, if you will. I found certain codes that govern my approach to relationship that get me what I want. I know how to have a hangdog look on my face to manipulate my wife. I know what it is to come home from work and having had a bad day and wanting very much for her to respond. And so I'll walk in the door and she'll hear me coming and she'll say, "Hi, you home? How you doing?" And I'll say, "I'm all right. I might as well hold up a cue card." And I found certain ways that will get a response out of her that's the kind of one that I want. I want something that works. And when I find this something that works, something inside of me feels powerful. I know what I'm doing and I can make it happen. I feel powerful and I feel wickedly satisfied. And down deep I feel strangely guilty. The emptiness that comes from uncourageous, non-creative living compulsively drives me to find something that works, and secondly, it drives me to find someone who cares. Now listen to what I mean by this. What I'm talking about here is not someone who cares in a legitimate sense of the word, but I'm talking about someone who doesn't require us to create, or to put it differently, someone who doesn't require us to be men. The roots, I would suggest, of sexual perversion are an opportunity for intimacy with no requirement to create. The roots of the homosexual urge, an opportunity to feel connected in a way that our souls long to feel connected without being required to create something out of the deepest part of my masculine soul, because only a woman can require the depths of masculine creation. And therefore, I'm more drawn, if there's a real problem here, still longing for intimacy, I'm more drawn to those situations where there's no deep requirement to create. I want to be with someone. I want to be someplace where all the pressure is taken off. I don't want to have the pressure on my life anymore. You've all felt that way. You all feel so much pressure in your work and in your responsibilities, and you just, you know, stop the world, let me get off kind of a mood. I just want a day away. I just want to go on a vacation, or on my vacation, I don't want anybody to find me there and to call me and bring up a business problem. One of the difficulties in when you write books and your picture's on it is sometimes you go places and people recognize you when you don't want to be recognized. I've been on vacation in places where people come up, and my wife and I took our 25th anniversary trip last June, went back to Bermuda where we hadn't been in 25 years. We honeymooned there 25 years ago, and we're sitting in this hotel that we had been in 25 years ago. It was 25th anniversary. We're sitting having dinner in a hotel, and a couple walks up carrying the book, Men and Women Enjoying the Difference. And frankly, it didn't feel like, you know, celebrity status, good time, aren't I important? It didn't feel that way. What it felt like was, oh, did you have to? They walked up and said, "You Larry Crabb?" And I felt like saying, "No, Harvey Schmidt, but I've won the Larry Crabb lookalike contest." I want to find someone who's going to take all the pressure off, who's not going to require me to do anything. And the obvious sources of that are a prostitute. $50 and she'll not require a thing from you. Playboy centerfolds aren't demanding. Cable TV, sexual fantasies. When the emptiness is relieved, when that process is set in motion and the emptiness is relieved, then the addictive process is kicked into gear. When there's not the deep satisfaction of soul that comes from courageously creating in chaos, when the deep satisfaction of soul that comes from that process is absent, and then I find something else that seems to work, or someone who cares, by taking the pressure off and saying, "You deserve a break today," then something inside of me says, I'll live for you. And I'll get more of you. And the process is kicked into gear. That could begin with a tender look from a secretary, the kind of look you don't get from your wives. Gentlemen, if we don't know how to love, if we don't know how to courageously create, if we don't know how to take the clay of our manhood and shape it into a substance and give it away, if we don't know how to do that, to give of ourselves to another for the sheer sake of giving, for the sheer joy of being alive as men, then we're going to become addicted to what I call this morning being in love. We're going to become addicted to the excitement of sensual type pleasure, and we're going to be needing fresh excitement all the time. Another girl, another porno magazine, another sexual position, wilder deviations, and pretty soon our search for being in love will lead us to anything that provides even a moment of pleasure. How many lives have gone down the tubes in just that way? All because when things were tough and the man felt without a code, had no idea what to do, he refused to speak. He refused to stay involved. I spoke just a week ago with a good friend, a man who years ago we had considered asking us to join our ministry in a major collegial role. A friend whose life is now in the process of being put back together. The pieces are shattered all over the place. He was with a woman who was very difficult for him to love in a variety of ways. He knew very little of fatherhood. He had about four or five different fathers. He knew nothing of the joys of fatherhood. He had some level of meaningful brotherhood, but he managed to harden himself in spite of that. And he didn't give to his wife because she wouldn't give to him what his empty soul wanted. And so he turned to relationships that made no demands. He's gone through two or three women since. And now, this last week at breakfast, with a degree of emotion, he said, it's just so hard to not be with my children. It's so hard to be away. There's a price to pay for our not being men. There's a price to pay for that void being created within us by our lack of courage that leads to an inability to control certain temptations in our lives go down the tubes. Now, where are you with all this as I'm teaching? Are you living by code? Does that make sense to you? Do you hear what I'm talking about when I say that? Do you know what I mean when I say that there's a need for courage? Is that communicating? Can you translate that into your own lives as opposed to just following a seminar concept? Is your life okay down deep or just on the surface of things? How have you handled, how have I handled the absence of a father or brother? And in one sense, we've all been without the fullness of what we want in a father and brother. Even those whose hands were raised, and my hand would go up, even those whose hands were raised would have to say it's not been all that we wanted in either father or brother. And there's therefore going to be some struggle with believing that we have what it takes to move into life when there's no code. And are we aware that in so many things that we do, so much of the passions that control us, so much of the energy that motivates us, really is nothing more than an attempt to find what works in someone who cares in order to relieve the pain caused by our failure to create. Now, let me see if I can give a little bit of help. Turning to the next concept now. Let me see if I can give a little bit of help as you turn to your next page in identifying where maybe we are. This next little bit is meant to be only diagnostic, not explanatory. In the next few minutes, I simply want to give a little picture for how we tend to relate, how we tend to approach things. That may help us position ourselves and get a better picture of where we are in this whole subject of manhood and handling it creatively that we're talking about today. And in order to position ourselves and get some categories that maybe we can see where we fit, let me talk about three spheres of life that we all live within. This is very obvious. I'm just organizing it in one way. There's thousands of ways to organize this, but see if these obvious sentences can start making some sense in light of the material of the day. There are three spheres of life that all of us live within. The first sphere of life is just the ordinary, everyday, routine responsibilities. All of us know what it is to have a variety of responsibilities. When the seminar is over at 4:30, we have certain things that we're responsible to do. If we're married, our wives expect us home by 5:30 or 6 o'clock. If we're not married, we still have other responsibilities, things that have to be done. I've put off paying my monthly bills. I've been working so hard on this stuff that I haven't paid my monthly bills, and I'm going to spend probably Sunday evening paying my bills. or Monday morning or sometime, I'll be working on my bills. It'll be a little bit late, and I'll be getting a few notices here and there, but I'll just go ahead and take care of it. And the few little problems that I'm going to have in terms of a notice saying your payment is 2 days late, I'm going to handle okay, because I'm going to just probably postmark it earlier or something like that, you know. And we've all got bills to pay and jobs to do and ball games to watch and purchases to make and children's school programs to attend and dinner parties to go to and lots of things that take up most of our time. And I would suggest that authentic men live responsibly in the everyday world. Now, that's all I mean by the everyday world. That's pretty clear, pretty obvious, basic stuff. Second world, that we're all called upon to encounter because we're all in it, is what I call the empty life. Not the everyday life, but now the empty life or the empty world. The empty life of disappointment, failure, abuse, and rage. Most of us know that beneath our everyday schedules and responsibilities, there's a gnawing realization that something is not as it should be. Things just aren't right. Sometimes that fact slaps us in the face when planes crash. Sometimes that fact slaps us in the face when wives say, "I'm taking off." Sometimes that fact slaps us in the face when daughters say, "Sorry, Dad, but I'm pregnant." Sometimes that fact slaps us in the face and we get together for a family reunion and have a terrible time with all our relatives. And we begin to realize that our community is just not what we long for it to be. We realize the truth of what the Bible says when the Bible says that each one of us lives our lives now out of the garden. When God created Adam and Eve, He put them in paradise, and then when they sinned, He threw them out. And you and I are living post the sin of Adam and Eve, post-fall. We're living outside of the garden and something is wrong. And a rather gloomy sort of a thought that I think needs to be underscored is that in our lives, something is wrong with everything. The best relationship you have, the best job you have. There's a certain disappointment, a certain failure. There's the possibility of being abused in certain ways. There's an anger that comes to our souls because we are now living in a world that we were not designed to live in. God did not intend me to live in a world that's as messy as this. He intended me rather to live in paradise. And even maybe more importantly, He did not intend me to know the meaning of pain. He did not intend me to know the meaning of bad. But when Eve and Adam ate the tree of what tree was it? Fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And the word evil could equally well be translated bad. Just bad things. Hard things in life. Alcoholic fathers. Wives who are critical. And kids that get in trouble. And jobs that don't work. And bills that exceed income. And that's something that God never intended me to experience. God intended me to live in a certain sense as a little child trusting my father. You see a little two-year-old child and you see daddy just tossing the kid up in the air. And maybe the first time the kid is like that, but then he's caught. And the second time, a little less, third, fourth, fifth time, provided you don't drop the kid, there's just a certain kind of a mood of the kid is just, you know, everything's wonderful because daddy's down there with strong arms. That's what God intended life to be like. And it's just not that way. Things don't work. Most of us have a strong commitment to not face how badly things aren't working. Sometimes things are so bad, we don't know how to go on. But usually, what we men with our creative capacities do is we misuse our creative capacities. We prostitute our abilities to create and find some way to create the illusion that things are better than they are. That's a misuse of our creative capacities. We find some way to create the illusion that things are better than they are, and we look for opportunities for pleasure, opportunities for power, opportunities for impact, opportunities for something that will somehow make us feel good without ever being required to create in the middle of paralysis. I'm a Chicago Bulls fan. I love to watch Michael play. They played the Celts last, what night was it, Thursday? Is that right? Wednesday, maybe. And I invited a bunch of guys over and watched the Celts. And the Bulls play. Michael had 40-something or other. It was a great night. It was fun. Anything wrong with having a good night with a bunch of guys watching a sports program like that? No, I think it's super. The issue is, what do I use it for? Do I use nights like that to pretend, there's no problems, I'm doing fine? Or do I use nights like that as a nice breather from some of the problems? That's fair. What do you do with the empty worlds that you live in? I live in an empty world of disappointment, failure, abuse, anger. That's my world, just like yours. It's everybody's world. I'm not saying my life is not good. I've got a good life. I've got a wonderful wife, 2 super kids. A lot of things are going well for me. But I'll tell you something. If eternal life meant this life, forever and ever and ever, man, I'm looking around for alternatives. There's a third sphere that I want to speak about for just a moment, the energetic life, I call it. The energetic life, where we feel energized, by connection to somebody good and to something important. Energized by connection to somebody good and something important. One thing that we're just going to have to understand, and it's hard for me to grasp, but it may be hard for you as well, that I can't make it alone. There are certain things that I face in my world. There are certain parts of my life that I'm just not up to handling. The difficulty is there's a fair amount of my life that I'm quite up to handling. But there are certain parts that once in a while I realize if there's not a connection of something deep within me to someone better than me, stronger than me, more powerful than me, if there's not a connection of who I am and what I'm doing to some thing, some purpose that's more important than the few things that I'm doing now, if there's not some sense of connection, then when I'm facing life at its fullest, I realize that I'm destroyed and I have nothing. This third world, the energetic life of connection, is a world that I really believe very, very few men enter. I think we're committed to not entering it. We're committed to using our creative capacities in a very prostituted way to avoid entering the world as I'm speaking of it. I've told the story before publicly. I've told it maybe 3 or 4 times, and it still hasn't lost power. It doesn't feel like a recited story yet. Maybe it will at some day. But 2 weeks after Bill died, last March 3rd, I told my wife in the 2 weeks after that, that there were tears within me that had not yet been shed. I wept, all of us did. It was a significant loss for our family, of course. And within 2 weeks, I remember saying to Rachel one Sunday morning as we got up to go to church, I made a decision to go to church that day. I said, I remember saying to her with some real feeling, I said, honey, there's tears within me that I haven't cried yet. And I don't know what they're from. But I sense that those tears are coming from a deeper source than the loss of my brother. It's hard to imagine a much deeper source than that. The tears that came from that have been as rich tears as I've cried in my life. But I remember saying to her, I think there's something worse, and I don't know what it is, and there's a grief within me I don't know how to identify. The tears haven't come. That night they did, for reasons I don't understand. Got up midnight, went to my study, and I cried. I wailed. I sobbed. And the words that I said, I'll never forget the words that I said. I don't think I'll ever forget them. I said these words out loud, almost in a screaming tone. I said, God, I think I'm beginning to understand that you're all that I have to connect with. But I'm not sure if I know you well enough for you to be all that I need. You're all that I have. I don't know you well enough for you to be all that I need. That third world is not an easy one. Connection. With what? There are some people in our modern supernaturalized culture, as we've seen the poverty of materialism, the poverty of our technological revolution, there are a number of people now who are saying there's got to be more than things. And as a result, we're moving into a variety of counterfeit supernatural directions to connect with something other than the only one that can be connected with. Three worlds to live in. Where do we live? What do we know of each one? I want to suggest to you that the way we handle these three worlds and how we deal with these three spheres of life, may lead us to a little set of categories that might pinpoint where you and I are. I want to talk about 4 kinds of men. The first kind of men I call comfortable men. Let me tell you about comfortable men. Comfortable men are men who do their best to block out the empty life and the energetic life. Comfortable men are men who, when you talk to them, they say, things are just great. How's it going? Fine, thanks. Any problems? None whatsoever. Well, maybe there's a few problems here and there, but hey, we all have problems. Things are super. I think it's fair to say that at times. I had a call from a good friend last night. How's it going, Larry? And I said, great. Things are going well? I said, super. Does that mean I'm a comfortable man? Sure, at certain moments. I think it's great. I'm all for comfort. I'm not knocking this necessarily. I'm asking, are we there defensively, refusing to go anywhere else? Things are fine. And my commitment, unspoken often, but very real, is I don't want it messed up. So take a hike if you want to talk deep. Don't you bug me with all these heavy things. Typical psychologist that complicates simple things and make a mess out of life. I got enough friends. I'm doing all right. Yeah. I golf with George and I, you know, play tennis with Bill and I do all sorts of things. I'm all right. Got a good job. Yeah, I could make a little more money, but I'm doing all right. Family's all right. Yeah. Wife's good looking, still shapely. Everything's fine. No need to really look any deeper. Let me tell you the characteristics of comfortable men. If that's a description, here's some characteristics. Comfortable men are often very sociable. The kind you love to be with at a party, but you never go to when you're grieving. They're sociable. They're often leaders, typically low-level leaders, but sometimes big time. The people that have no close friends, they can't get real close to anybody. They're everybody's buddy and nobody's best friend. You try to get close, they stiff-arm you. Comfortable people typically have no real passion. And as you get to know them, there's nothing in you that is drawn out by them. Things stay at a shallow level. Comfortable men are incapable of deep feelings. There's no real passion. Their wives are going mad, wondering if there's anything authentic about their womanhood, because they find themselves longing for more, but their guys seem so friendly and happy and everything's fine that they begin to say, I guess I'm weird for wanting more. What's the matter with me? I'll find some way to adjust to this man by killing my soul. Comfortable men are defensive and angry when pushed to look hard at their lives. Comfortable men refuse to take a look at the two spheres of life that eliminate comfort. Second category I call troubled men. See if that confusing sketch makes any sense. Troubled men. Men that have no awareness in a meaningful, experiential way of the energetic life. But they're men who realize that there's been a few problems going on. Things are not all that good. There's a few things going on, and they're open to your thoughts. I've faced some of the struggles of life, and yeah, I do feel kind of empty, and yeah, things aren't so good at home, but they aren't that bad. I'm still making it. Let's not get too serious about this. I'm open to your thoughts, but don't upset things too much, because I'm still doing okay. I was able to snap back up and get into the everyday life, and I'm still okay, but yeah, I know something's wrong. That's the difference in troubled men. They know something's wrong. They're troubled by something deeper than comfortable men have ever faced. Those are their characteristics. Let me tell you their description, rather. Let me tell you their characteristics. They're willing to talk at meaningful levels to some degree, but there's a real limit. They're willing to talk about things, and they'll open up to some degree, but you realize you hit a steel plate at some point. There's often hidden problems going on in troubled men's lives that they can't understand or overcome. They're not sure why they have that strange sexual fantasy that they can't stop thinking about when they make love to their wives. They're not sure why they have so many weird thoughts. They're bothered by it. But they just kind of ignore it and get back to living their everyday lives. They dip down into the struggles of emptiness, face it for a moment, get terrified, and run back up to everyday living and obsess themselves with whatever will numb the pain. They're easily discouraged men. They're men who often lose their motivation because they know that living in the everyday world and trying hard to be mature and responsible there isn't dealing with what needs to be dealt with. A whole lot of people these days are trying to make it by doing nothing more than being increasingly responsible in whatever tasks are set before them. A lot of troubled people are very, very responsible people, but they're compulsively responsible. There's no spontaneity or freedom. And their responsibility is a way of getting putting their distance between them and the real struggles of life. If I can just be responsible, if I can just make things work, I think I'll be all right. I don't want to go down and look harder at what's happening in my life. I call those troubled men. Third kind of men, I call them dysfunctional men. They've tried to live in their everyday worlds, but their everyday worlds were not making it. They had so many problems in the deeper level of the empty life. Their life was so empty, so full of struggles, that they've dipped down to that world. And when they've gotten to that world, they face that things are so bad that they say, it's a mess, and I just can't handle it. I know my life is a mess, and I simply have no idea what to do about it. These are sometimes what people look like after a little bit of counseling. Not doing too bad, coming in as trouble, help with my troubles. Then the counselor says, well, look at what's happening in your dysfunctional world. Well, my dad was pretty good. Pretty good. He left you when you were 5 years old. Yeah, but he wrote now and then. How'd that struck your soul? Did that touch your soul in ways you want to be touched? No, I guess it didn't. In other words, you're dying inside. And after some good counseling like that, life's a whole lot more of a mess than it was before you started. And sometimes when you enter the reality of how bad things are, in your world, in my world, sometimes it's like a quicksand that keeps you in its power, and you feel like you lose all your power, and you end up saying, I have no power over what matters. I need help. The characteristics of dysfunctional men, I would suggest they're often angry, demanding, and self-focused. They're oftentimes very angry people. It shouldn't be this way. It's just not right. A lot of us have a very keen sense of justice in terms of how the world has treated us. And something inside of us says, given the way I've been treated, and given how hard it's been for me to experience all that I've gone through, given how badly I've been treated in terms of justice, I never deserved that as a 3-year-old kid to have this happen. I never deserved at age 10 to have this happen. I never deserved at age 15 to have this happen, given that all these offenses against justice have been created against me. Therefore, I think it's fairly acceptable for me to find some relief in ways that violate justice. Justice really would serve the purpose of bringing me relief. So I'll do whatever brings relief. Responsibility, out the window. Unless it helps. But living responsible lives and working harder doesn't numb the pain of what's happening in the empty life that dysfunctional men live in the middle of all the time. These are men that are often in the middle of some kind of addiction with no capacity whatsoever to give. Dysfunctional men. Last kind of men, on the overhead in your notes I have resolved, maybe connected is a better word, resolved men or connected men. Men that have had the courage, maybe, or by necessity have had to face that living in the everyday world isn't cutting it. Men who've had to face that just trying harder and coming home on time and making sure you don't forget your wife's birthday and taking her out for dinner once a week and making sure you spend time with your kids, that somehow it really doesn't do the job. It doesn't take care of the pain. I remember a woman who I chatted with a few years ago. She came to one of our seminars, and my associate Dan was teaching on sexual abuse. And she was an 18-year-old young lady sitting in the back of the room, and I was back. And she began crying as Dan talked about sexual abuse. And I went back to her, and I said, could I be of help? And she said, yes, in tears. We went back and chatted, and she told me. She said that... She said, my pastor told me I must not come to your seminar. And I said, why? And she said, because his position is that if we simply do everything that God says, all of our problems will be taken care of. If we simply try harder to be obedient to God, make sure that we do whatever a good Christian girl should do, all these things will be taken care of in our lives. And all you're doing is bringing in some of this looking at your own life in ways that just messes people up. And I said, well, what'd you come for? And she said, for the last 4 years, I've committed myself with every power within me to do everything right, to live this, to live the way a teenage girl ought to live. I've been obedient to my parents. I've worked hard at school. I've had appropriate dating relationships. No man or no boy has touched me in ways that he shouldn't. I've been everything I'm supposed to be. And internally, I'm dying. Resolved people are people who know that just being everything you're supposed to be doesn't seem to take care of the real issues. And you begin facing what's happening in your soul, and there's great pain, there's great emptiness. And that emptiness has smashed your pride. The emptiness has been so severe that you've ended up saying, I really need connection outside of myself. And if the connection has been illegitimate, let me tell you what you look like. There are a fair number of people, I think an increasing number in our society, of people who are illegitimately connected and therefore see that their lives are somewhat well resolved. Unhealthy resolution I would define basically this way, as some form of connection that ends the chaos. Some form of connection that eliminates the need to be fully courageous in every situation. Now I've figured out, I've got it together. I'm fine now. And I'm no longer in denial. I faced my alcoholic father. I faced the abandonment. I faced how my mother possesses me. I faced how my friends relate to me in ways that I've been trapped by and addicted to. I faced all that. I'm not in denial. But I've gotten in touch with me. I've gotten in touch with my right to live a certain way. I'm now free. I'm in touch with the truth of who I am. I'm fine now, and I'm not in denial, says the unhealthily connected. And with an almost demanding zeal, I want you to know what I know. People like this are usually pushy in their evangelistic fervor. Their characteristics are that they're full of self-confidence in a way that's very unattractive. There's a calmness through storms that doesn't somehow seem legitimate. And there's a dependence on the connection that seems to keep that person from giving humbly, sacrificially, and quietly to others. If you're making it today, ask yourself on what basis? Does it feel like you're making it because you're a comfortable man who's never looked beneath the surface into the emptiness of your life and faced the fact that your wife is dying inside at the time? Faced the fact that what you're doing doesn't matter that much to many people? That you really don't know how to live in a lot of ways and you're not sure what to tell your children when they ask you, Daddy, teach me to live? If you're making it, is it because you're comfortable or is it because you're unhealthily connected? If you're healthily connected, and I think that there are some men who are making it legitimately. I think this is a hope we can all look forward to. But a legitimate, healthy connection is one that does not end the chaos. It's one that sustains us through the chaos. The chaos continues until the day we die. It's always striking for me and somewhat discouraging to talk to my father, who's pushing 80 years old, and to realize he's still struggling with a lot of things. There's been times internally I've just felt so angry at him. Dad, couldn't you be beyond the struggles by now? Give me a little hope for growing older? But Dad is a man whose connection has not ended his chaos, but it's sustaining him through it. When Bill died, he told me he went outside after he got the news and he screamed at God for 10 minutes. And then when God didn't repent, he chose to trust him. a connection that sustains us through chaos, that makes the present, now listen to this, that makes the present chaos and pain and suffering no longer the point of our lives. It's there, but it's not the point. It's not the focal point. We're not looking for relief. There's not some internal void that's requiring relief. There's still chaos. There's still pain. There's still suffering, but it somehow isn't central. And the struggles that we have are regarded as an opportunity for the demonstration of something wonderful within. A healthily connected person, see if you fit this description. A healthily connected person would say things like this: I hurt badly. And I'm confused about a lot of things, but something within me can still move and can still give. A healthily connected person is one who says, I hurt badly and I'm confused. There are many times in my life and I don't know what I'm doing. Sometimes I'm feeling great, but sometimes I hurt badly. But even when I hurt at my worst, I know there's something within me that can still move and can give. A healthily connected person is one who knows the deepest joys of manhood, which ultimately is the transmission of life. I want you to participate in what I found. But only as you are drawn to it through me, there'll be no high-pressure sales. The characteristics of a healthily connected, resolved person is that he's humble. He's not full of himself. He's found a far more interesting topic than his own life. That'd be progress for a lot of us, wouldn't it? There are times he's very threatened, deeply paralyzed, but somehow he still stays strong and moving. Four kinds of men. Be asking yourself the question, none of us fits real cleanly into any one category, I'm sure, but what do these categories do to help us understand where we are? Are we comfortable men who are saying, everything's fine, don't bug me? If that's where you are as we're meeting this afternoon, if that's your lifestyle, that you're comfortable men, then I must tell you that you have very little power and very little passion. If you're a comfortable man, you're not impacting anybody very deeply. Your life is not very important the way you're living it. And I invite you to look hard at the quality of your relationships as I must look at mine. And those six questions we talked about earlier today, maybe they might be a good place to start. If you're a troubled man, if you're saying, I know something's wrong, but I'm getting on okay, I think, but I'm open to your thoughts. If that's where you are, then I invite you to face those spheres of life where things are terribly wrong and where you can't jump back up into the everyday sphere and make it all better. There's some things that are very, very wrong and you have no idea what to do about it. You just don't know what to do, how to handle the situation Monday morning that you have to face. You got a phone call coming in next Wednesday afternoon. You have no slightest idea what to do. Face that. I invite you to do that if you're a troubled man. If you're a dysfunctional man, if you're saying everything's a mess, my life is totally fouled up, I need help, then I invite you to face your rage at God and your rage at others for the unfair treatment you've suffered. And reflect on how badly you long for a father and brother, but how you've given so little of either of those elements to anybody else. Face how badly you need connection. If you're an unhealthily connected man, if you're saying, I'm not in denial and I'm doing fine, then I would ask you this, is there a deep passion, now listen to this phrase, is there a deep passion for someone more than yourself? Is there a gratitude that's stronger than self-confidence, a willingness to give despite the personal suffering that it costs? If you're a healthily connected person, there may be a few in our midst today, and you're saying things like this, I'm struggling hard, and I face every day paralyzing moments where I don't know what to do, but I know that there's a substance within me that when I mold it within my own hands and give it away, that there's something of value that I can give away. My greatest joy is being who I am on behalf of others. I'm struggling, but I know where I'm headed. If that's your position, then you get up and take the mic and teach the rest of the afternoon. And I invite you to lead me into a deeper passion for God. The effects of all this, we're troubled, we're comfortable, we're dysfunctional, unhealthily connected, Our lives are not what they should be. What's caused the problem? Topic three. What's caused the problem? We lack courage. We live by code. We suffer from no one believing in us or listening to us. We tend to stay away from hard times and stay comfortable, or we admit some things are hard but get on with life as a troubled person, or we face what a mess things are and become dysfunctional, or we connect ourselves to something wrong and think we're doing fine when we're not. It's kind of an upbeat thought, isn't it? And as a result, our wives feel little passion from us, our sons feel pressured, our daughters feel dangerous, our friends feel distant, and our fathers feel dismissed. Or hated. What's behind all this? If you're with me so far in the day, and you're following some of it and agreeing with a little of it here and there, then I think the question that would naturally be in any of our minds is, how things get so bad? And is there a way out? Is this day going to end on an up note or not an up note? Well, hope's going to be an up note. I think there's great hope. But there's a principle that I think runs through every experience in life, and that is that we never know the fullness of the hope until we know the depths of the problem. And therefore, rather than just a pep talk on let's go out and be men and do all that we're supposed to be doing with our lives, maybe we need to face that there's something that's gotten very twisted down deep in our beings that just isn't good at all. Robert Bly, when he tries to understand the problem, he takes the position that it's fair to look at literature and to believe that if there are enduring themes that run through literature for the ages, that those enduring themes may have value. And he has, as a poet and as a literary scholar, he has gone through a lot of the old-time literature looking for themes, and he stumbled upon one particular fairy tale by the Brothers Grimm called Iron John. And he's looked at that myth, that fairy tale, written a long time ago, and extracted themes from that and presented us with themes that come out of that that maybe can help us understand what's going on and what's happening in our souls. And I think that's a fair procedure to do. That's true all the way through. And that whatever it teaches, we can trust. And whatever themes it suggests, we don't have to be critical of. We can accept and seek to understand as opposed to evaluate and see whether we like it or not. Or whether it's true. And that, of course, is the Bible. And if you have your Bibles, many of you don't, of course, but if you do, turn to Genesis. And I want to look at a thought here that might help us get at what I think the central problem is in people's lives, in men's lives. The first man got us in trouble. How did he do it? We're all his heirs in a very meaningful and difficult sense. There's an inherited tendency that just plain comes naturally to men. An inherited tendency that Adam began a long time ago and has been passed on to you and me, and that every man that's been born has this tendency which Adam got started. Let me tell you how I think it works. Look at Genesis chapter 2 and verse 15. Genesis 2 and verse 15, the Lord God took the man and put him, Eve wasn't around yet, the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and take care of it. And the Lord God commanded the man, you are free to eat from any tree in the garden. Notice the focus of that phrase. You are free to eat from any tree. In other words, it's my liberality which is the point. Any tree in the garden, it's all yours. Have a blast. I made it for you. Have a good time. I'm into pleasure. Be happy. That's God talking to Adam. You're free to eat from any tree in the garden, but because I'm God and you're not, I know what's best for you, and I'm giving you an instruction that you must keep to keep the relationship between us straight. I'm the creator, you're the creature. And here's the prohibition. You must not eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, for when you eat of it, you will surely die. It was after he gave that instruction that he created Eve. Do you ever think about that? Why did God not wait until Eve was created to give the instruction to both man and woman? Why did he give it just to man? That's what he did. He didn't give it to the woman directly. He gave it to the man, for whatever reason. Chapter 3, a problem developed. Eve is now created. Adam, no doubt, had communicated to her after they got acquainted. That must have been quite a time. He had never seen a woman before. All he had seen were a bunch of animals that he had named, and then all of a sudden, God says, take a nap, wake up, look over there. And my guess is they got along fantastically. Everything was great. You all have moments in your life that last for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, when everything's great. Everything's super. Paradise. Everything's fine at home. The bills are paid and your desk is clear and your car is washed and it's working and, you know, your wife's kind of happy and she thinks you're neat and you just lost 10 pounds. You're working out regularly. You got plenty of energy. The boss gave you a raise. Everything's super. And you figure, I got it made. Now, what do you hate the most when everything's going super? Something to mess it up. Everything's going super, and up comes a snake. Who did the snake go to? Now, the serpent, chapter 3, was more crafty than any of the wild animals the Lord God had made. And so he said to the woman, God said to the man, here's the prohibition, here's the opportunity. The serpent says to the woman, he didn't go to Adam, he goes to the woman and begins with this, did God really say you must not eat from any tree in the garden? The woman then replied to the serpent and said, we may eat fruit from the tree. She didn't say from any of the trees. She missed the point of God's liberality. We must eat fruit from the trees in the garden, but God did say, you must not eat fruit from the tree that's in the middle of the garden, and you must not touch it. God hadn't said that. Eve was beginning to see God as more limiting than in fact he was. Or you will die. You will not surely die, the serpent said to the woman. God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. When the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye, and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took some and ate it. She also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate it. Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they realized they were naked. Here's a question I want to ask you. Was Adam there when the serpent tempted Eve? Some say no, some say yes. What does it mean when he says, she also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate it? My associate Dan called up an Old Testament scholar, a friend of his, a very high-level Old Testament scholar. He teaches at a theological seminary in Old Testament studies, and he called him up last week, and he said, was Adam there when the serpent tempted Eve? And the guy said, nah. Dan said, how do you know? He responded by saying, well, it just doesn't make sense. He wasn't there. And Dan said, well, you're a scholar. Could you do better than that? Could you get your Bible? You mean my Hebrew Bible? Well, yeah, you're a Hebrew scholar. Get your Hebrew Bible and look at it. Now? Yeah, now. So he got his Hebrew Bible, and Dan's on the phone talking to this friend of his, and he's listening on the phone as the scholar is muttering in Hebrew, looking at the text, you know, and all this. And after about 5 minutes of Dan listening to this Hebrew scholar mutter, the scholar burst out and said, the son of a gun was there. The argument of those who say he was there, and there's some who would say he wasn't, but the argument of those who would say he was there includes a variety of things, but one of the things that's involved in this argument is that the entire narrative, Genesis 3, 1 through 7, is constructed in the Hebrew in a way, and this is out of my depth, so I'll say it quickly since I have no idea what I'm talking about. It was constructed in a way that the author intended the reader to take this as one unit. A package unit. regardless of how long the actual sequence took. Perhaps the serpent tempted Eve, and a couple days later she thought about it and said, maybe I'll go back to that tree and have some. And then she took a bite and then went over and found Adam a couple hours later. I mean, all that's possible, but the way the unit is described here is a way of saying, don't take it that way. My question is this. If Adam was there, why didn't he talk? If Adam was there, and I believe he was, why didn't he talk? Why do I not talk? Why are there situations into which I will not speak? Why, when my wife presents me with paralyzing situations, do I not speak with courage into the chaos? Is there an inherited tendency from Adam that every man in this room and every man born since Adam except our Lord inherited? If Adam was there, why didn't he say anything? Has the silence of Adam been passed on to us, and now we're silent too? Unlike God, in whose image we've been created, I love the title of Francis Schaeffer's book, he is there, and he is not silent. He's spoken into the mess that we've created. And I don't speak into the mess unless I have a code where I'm pretty guaranteed I can pull it off. What makes it worse is that the New Testament teaches that Eve was deceived. Paul says this in 1 Timothy, that Eve was deceived and Adam wasn't deceived. It gets worse, folks. Adam got things off on a bad start. I would suggest that Adam's silence was the beginning of the fall. The fall was the eating of the fruit. But every sin begins with something that culminates. Lust, when it conceives, brings forth sin, the Bible says. Adam wasn't deceived. Eve was. And when the Bible says that Eve was deceived, it's really a moral word. And the idea of the word is this, that when you're deceived the way Eve was, it means you come to a fork in the road. You can go this way or you can go this way. You aren't deceived about which way you're supposed to go. You're deceived about the consequences of what's going to happen if you go the wrong way. Here's a way that I'm probably not supposed to go. I don't know. But, well, no, I shouldn't go this way. This is the right way, but, you know, this way is going to result in, that's going to work pretty well, isn't it? There's a way that seems right. The end thereof are the ways of, I think it'll work out fine, thanks. Eve was deceived. And you see, what I think actually happened, I take the Genesis narrative as literal as opposed to myth in the sense of fiction, and if it actually happened this way, then picture what actually took place. It's what happens in my home all the time. Things are going along pretty well. And then something comes up. Now, I don't know what to do. So I put on the TV. Things are going along pretty well for Adam and Eve, and the serpent comes up, and the serpent's talking to Eve and says, this is what God said, and Eve says, well, let me think of how I got this right now. My husband told me this a little while ago. Here's how I remember it. And she's getting deceived now. She's in the middle of a moral deceptive process where she's starting to believe that bad leads to good, and she's going in this direction, and Adam didn't say a word. What should he have done? Seems to me he ought to have spoken up. He ought to have said, hang on a minute here. No, honey, that's not what I said. No, well, this snake here is not telling you the truth. He's leading you in wrong directions. I don't want you to move in this direction. It's not what our Father has told us. It's not what the God who walks with us in the cool of the day has told us. Honey, this is not to be. When's the last time you talked to your wife like that? How'd it go? Chauvinist pig. He knew God's word. He had heard it correctly. He understood it. But he didn't speak. And then even worse, after having not spoken, and Eve took of the fruit and came to Adam and said, here, take a bite. God later, when he judged Adam, said, because you listened to the voice of your wife, I'm going to punish you. And my question again is why? Why was Adam silent? The major question. And the answer to it, I think, will give us some clues as to why we tend to be silent, and maybe give us some clues as to what has to happen for us to overcome our culpable, unmasculine, self-centered and sinful silence. Some time ago, I was having dinner. My wife and I were having dinner with two friends of ours. He happens to be a Bible scholar as well. And it was Rachel and me and these two folks. Call them Joe and Sally. And we're having a nice time. Everything was going well. Just a nice little dinner party. Two couples, good friends, enjoy each other. Good meal at their home. She had cooked up a great meal. We're having a good time. Just easy, relaxing evening. Everything's fine. It's a little bit like paradise. Everything's okay. The phone rings. Sally answers the phone, talks for about 10 minutes, and comes back to the table visibly distressed. Comes back to the table and says, Oh. Well, what do you do at that point? Her husband didn't do a thing. He just had another bite of food. I think my wife said, what's wrong? And Sally said, oh, that was my sister. And, oh, things in my family are just falling apart worse than ever. And she told us a very sad story about some current crisis in their family. And as she's talking, I'm kind of watching out of the side of my eye. I'm watching Joe over here. And she's talking, looking more at me and Rachel, not at Joe. And I'm thinking, why aren't you looking to him? And he's sitting up there eating and smiling, literally. He's just, I'm going, And she looked at me and she said, what do you think I ought to do? I said, talk to your husband. And she said, literally, she said, "I that's not what I tend to do at these times. And I said, what's it like for you as you talk about these things to have him eat and smile? It changed the complexion of the evening a little bit. And she said, that's what he always does. This is a good friend of mine, and don't hear this as something which ought to be done routinely, but he's a good friend, and I have a lot of respect for him. So I turned to him and I said, for the last 10 minutes, you have miserably failed your wife. You have participated in the sin of Adam. You've been silent when you should be speaking. His next words were, what am I to do? No code, no speech. But because this is a godly man, a good man, he didn't sleep that night. We talked a couple of days later, and he said, that's how I always treat her. I refuse to speak where I'm not sure of myself. And I said, well, you got it from your great-great-grandfather, Adam. That's no excuse, but that's what happened. You see, when the serpent came, the thing to realize is this. God had given Adam no forewarning about what was going to take place. Look for it in the text. It's not there. God did not say when he created Adam and then told him about the rules, no eating of this particular tree. Eat the rest of them, have a good time, but don't eat that one. Now take a nap. Here's your wife. Let me get the two of you guys together now. Let me tell you something's going to happen here. A couple days from now, a couple years, who knows how long, going to be a snake come up and start talking to you people. He's going to talk to the woman. And Adam, here's how a man is supposed to handle it. He didn't say that to him. There's no manual on how to handle the important things in life. Adam was left on his own. God never warned Adam what was coming, and he never told Adam what to do when it happened. Adam was left on his own. To remain within clear moral boundaries, God had made certain things clear. There are certain things you are not to do. There were certain clear moral boundaries. God had left Adam on his own to remain within clear moral boundaries, to believe God, certainly, but to figure out a way to respond to a situation that he didn't expect, that caught him off guard, caught him by surprise, that disrupted his pleasant experience, that he had received no specific instructions on how to handle. God, why didn't you say more? I think the answer is because that's how God made us, to enjoy our manhood. To create, As God creates, we create. He out of nothing, we out of something. We're not God, we're dependent, but we're like God. He creates, we're to create in His image and to move into our worlds when we don't have a clue what we're doing. He knew what He was doing. We have a harder time, but we have a God who's going to work with us, a God who gives us moral boundaries, and then He says, gentlemen, you go out and live like men. Here's your opportunity, Adam, to express the deepest part of your masculinity. An opportunity you couldn't have if the serpent wouldn't come. I permit everything ultimately for a good purpose. Here's your opportunity to express the deepest part of your masculinity, to take hold of a situation that you don't know how to handle in obedience to me and out of love for your wife. And Adam kept silent. When do we keep silent? When there's no code. What do we do rather than speak? We find some way to keep the peace. And what are the consequences? Relationships are hurt. Husband-wife tensions develop. And we wimp out by blaming everybody but ourselves. It's the woman you gave me got me in trouble here. Adam failed most centrally as a man. You and I fail most centrally in our masculinity. And as a result, we pass on a defective life to our sons who fail to speak as well. And end up empty in their masculinity, and the cycle continues. It's not the way it's supposed to be. It's the way it is. God didn't give Adam a code, didn't tell him what to do. He gave him parameters within which to operate, but He required Adam to have the courage to create in chaos, and Adam fell. What Adam should have done, what speaking would mean in that context, I would suggest, might be something like this. What Adam should have done is to speak, as the serpent was tempting his wife, to wrangle with his wife and to say, no, this is not to be, to risk her displeasure as he intrudes himself into her life, knowing that he's got a point to make. Having the courage to move in, risking displeasure. See, we don't do that. And then if she ate anyhow, what do you do when you speak and nothing happens right anyhow? When Eve brought the fruit to Adam, it seems to me what he should have done was something like this. Speaking at that point would have meant to refuse to eat. Honey, I will not do this. And then to come before God with the mess created by Eve's eating, pleading for a solution beyond his understanding. God, I don't know what to do here. My wife and I have lost everything we had because she yielded to the serpent. I've chosen to be obedient. Our relationship is over. God, I miss her. God, you designed me for pleasure to be with her. Is it all over now, God? I'll trust in your character as a good God and come before you as a child to his father saying, toss me in the air again, Daddy. I don't know how you're going to do it. And that's what we're supposed to do as men. Move into our worlds without a code. Living courageously within moral limits, being involved with a daughter who dresses provocatively, speaking to her, and risking her saying, oh, Dad, what do you mean my skirt's too tight? Oh, Dad, that's just ridiculous. And inside we do, jeez, why can't I have a kid who says, thanks so much, Dad, for your guidance. How do you speak into a situation when your son is smoking pot? Find me a book that'll tell you what to do on that. And if the book tells you exactly what to do, burn it. How do you speak to a wife who's furious, a friend who snubs you, a mother who possesses you, a father who fails you, an employer who's unfair, an employee who's lazy? Stay involved. Speak. What do we say? I don't know. Create. Well, that's not very satisfying. No, not to fallen men who demand a code. But it's an opportunity for men who want to create and are willing to take an awful, awful, awful risk. And very few of us do that. Very few men do it. It doesn't come naturally for us to do that, because our very natures are terrified to move without clear direction. That's the legacy, the inheritance we've gotten from Adam. We forfeited the birthright of manhood and traded it in for a mess of pottage, for whatever makes us feel good for the moment, because we have an inherited tendency to do so, passed on by Adam. That's at the root of our problem. It's just there. Just as a father and mother who have a disease pass it on to a child, so this disease has been passed on into my soul, and that's how I naturally operate. I will not speak when courage is required. I will speak when a code is in place, and I'm pretty sure of not failing and pretty sure of reward if I do such and such. Now, that's the disease that is in me, the time the sperm met the egg that is now me, that disease was passed on. That's part of me. But you know what's happened? The second part to our problem. The second part to our problem is that my experiences in life, from infancy and through boyhood on to adulthood, my experiences in life have reinforced that idea. Have reinforced the idea that maybe my manhood is not up to the job of speaking. I don't want to be required to speak, and maybe I've learned some lessons that support that retreat. And I want to talk for the next few minutes up until we break about assaults on manhood. Ways in which you and I have been assaulted. And everybody has been. Things that have happened in our lives that have convinced us that our natural tendency is reasonable. Things that have happened in our lives that have convinced us that the ways we naturally operate, given that we're all sons of Adam, are reasonable ways to operate. What has taken place in your life that has basically been a strong message to you saying, create out of chaos with courage? Forget it. I tried it once or twice. And frankly, all I did was get in trouble. And if you're saying that that's the route to life, it isn't the route to life, and I've got 20 experiences to back it up. I tried it, and it wasn't life, it was death. I felt terrible. I think of the guy that told me in counseling some time ago of the time that he and his dad, he was a 12-year-old boy, and they were building a workspace in the garage. And the father realized he didn't have certain equipment, so he said, look, I'm going to go to the hardware store and pick up some things and come back, be back in about 45 minutes or so. And while the father was gone, the 12-year-old boy thought, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to really please Dad. I'm going to take hold of something. I'm going to create. I'm not sure how to do this, but I'm going to go for it. I'm going to hang the pegboard where it's supposed to be behind the workbench. All it means is you got to put a couple of these big nails Dad was going to use to put the pegboard in, so I'm going to do that. So while Dad was gone, little 12-year-old boy very proudly found the nails and the hammer and kind of put it up and kind of held it up against it and got a nail in to hold it in place and then was able to put it in firmly. And he was so excited as he pounded those big nails in and he got that pegboard in so it couldn't be taken off by any natural force. And he just sat back and, you know, took the clay, molded it, and gave it. Look at that. Boy, Dad's going to be so excited. Dad came home and came into the garage. You know, good mood, happy day, just working with the son in the garage, getting things done. And he saw the pegboard up, and he realized that the boy had forgotten to cut holes for the electrical outlets to plug in the tools. And for whatever reason, he lost his temper. And he said, oh, geez, you forgot to cut out the outlets. I mean, now we're going to have to pull the whole thing off and it'll probably tear up the... Oh, for goodness. Well, let's get to it. How's a 12-year-old boy feel? Don't you take any risks again. You won't do it, but could you all stand up and tell your story? Do you all have a story to tell? When you hung a pegboard? When you did something that felt good? Natural, maybe? Aggressive? And it just didn't work out. What have been the assaults in your manhood? One thought that our men's group came up with, I think it's worth thinking about. There may be one symbolic event that didn't do all the damage, but symbolizes all the damage that's been done. Maybe for that gentleman, it's the pegboard experience. As I tell a few more illustrations to make my point, see if your minds can go to the time when it's happened to you. A friend of mine who struggles with homosexual impulses, he's happily married, and several children. He functions very well heterosexually, but he struggles with homosexual impulses and has for years. He told me the story as we were dealing with some of the struggles. He told me the story of how when he was 5 or 6 years old, this little boy had a younger sister, and the two of them were just playing together. That was his playmate. During the day, he'd have other boyfriends, and he'd be out jungle gym and throwing baseballs and all the good manly things that dad wants to watch their boys do. But in the evening, he just had a sister there. So his 3-year-old sister and he were sitting in the living room, and they were playing. They just happened to be playing with her dolls. Not because he was terribly attracted to dolls versus erector sets or baseballs or footballs, but it's something to do, and, you know, it's something to pass time with your little sister. So he was sitting there playing, just being natural, having a good time. You know, thinking nothing of it, nothing unmasculine, just being a little boy, playing with his sister. His dad walked in the living room. He came home from work, and he walked in, and he told me this. And when he told me, this is a 37-year-old man, he told me, he trembled as he told the story. He said, Dad walked in, and he looked down, and he saw me and my sister playing with dolls, and he didn't even look at my sister. He looked at me with a level of sneering disdain that's burned in my memory. I can't get it out of my mind. He literally began to shake up as he talked about it. And what Dad said, as he looked at me with this contemptuous, horrible, rejecting, sneering look, he said these words, boys don't play with dolls, and walked out of the room. What do you learn from that? What do you learn from hanging a pegboard and forgetting to put the holes in? My friend learned something along these lines. I wouldn't die by these words, but something in this category. My friend learned, I must not be a real boy, because real boys don't do this. I must never speak as a boy, because in some way I'm not one. Homosexual urges developed a few years later. In his young adulthood, he married a woman, hoping that would take care of the homosexual urge. It didn't, never does. He almost got a divorce. Until one day, they were sitting in my office, this couple. They had been separated now for several months. He had nothing but homosexual desires, no desire for his wife physically. We were sitting in the office, and he was telling me all these stories about his father sneering at him, about his lack of desire for his wife. And his wife, as he was telling the story, was sitting, I can still picture the office where I was sitting. He was here, and she was here, about 6-7 feet apart, the two chairs that I had, and I was over here in my chair. As he was telling me the story, I kind of watched her a bit. And he was saying how I just have no feelings for my wife at all, and I just don't have any desires for her, and I wish I did, but I don't. And I began to think, what is this poor woman going through? I looked over at her, and I've just never seen a more pathetic sight in my life. She's a little thing, and just was sitting there just like this, a pretty, very attractive young woman, but just sitting there just pathetic, and just like that. And I remember what I did. I turned to him, and I said, look at your wife. Never occurred to him to do that before. He looked at his wife. I said, what do you see? He said, she's not doing well. And I said, there's only one man in the history of time who can do for her what needs to be done. It's not me. You're the man. You get up out of your chair and you go over and you grab that lady. And he just, and he got up. And he walked over to her. And I'll tell you, it was the longest walk that man ever took. And he lifted her up out of her chair. And he grabbed her. The two of them literally fell on the couch together. And I left the room. Didn't know when to come back in. You kind of peek, you know. That was about 12 years ago. I speak with that man fairly regularly. His marriage is good. He still struggles occasionally with homosexual urges. He's fathered a few children. I was with him a while ago when I was speaking to a large group. I'm used to public speaking, but sometimes it's hard. And I was speaking to a room, large, huge room with 6,000 people in it. There were several speakers that spoke to the whole audience, and I was one of them. That morning, I was sitting out in the audience of 6,000 people listening to the morning speaker. I was the afternoon speaker. In a room that size, they had a big screen. It was 10 times the size of that screen, and it would project the face of the speaker on the screen. And I'm sitting out in the audience of 6,000 people watching a friend of mine up there preaching, looking at his huge face. You can see every pimple, every line, any saliva on the side of his mouth. You could see it, and, you know. And I'm thinking, I'm going to be up there this afternoon. Felt like asking for makeup from my wife. So I got up there, and it occurred to me as I walked to the pulpit to speak, the podium to speak that afternoon, it occurred to me there's only one person in the whole room that can't watch me on the screen. That's me. Because if I turn around and see the back of my head, see, camera's out there. I could never see myself. You know, back of the head. And for a variety of reasons, that unnerved me, and some other things unnerved me, and I didn't do a good job. A lot of you are public speakers, pastors, other folks, and you know what it's like to really bomb. I bombed from my position at all. Some folks told me they were helped. I didn't feel that I did a good job at all. I felt like I did a terrible job. Got off from that pulpit and went outside. I wanted to hide somewhere. And this friend, who 10, 15 years ago had gotten out of his chair and walked over to his wife, he had come to believe something about himself. He had come to believe there was clay within the depths of his soul, masculine clay that could be molded and given with impact. That had happened with his wife. And he said to me, how do you feel about what happened? It wasn't too hard to tell that I was feeling kind of discouraged. What would you do if you were a friend of mine and you saw me just really discouraged? What would be your temptation? Probably to say nothing, or, hey, that's pretty good, or, well, there's always next time. He entered me. He said, how'd you feel about that? And I said, I didn't feel very good. He said, can I buy you breakfast tomorrow morning? I said, well, sure. Met the next morning for breakfast for 3 hours. He began the conversation by saying, how come you got behind that podium with 6,000 people in the room expecting everybody to hate you? That really irritated me. I trained this guy in counseling and I was using it against me. And I remember my internal response was, pal, you want to take me on, you got yourself one fight. I know how to do this stuff. So I took out the sword of my tongue and we went like that. I tried to defeat him and he wouldn't let me defeat him. Here was a man who gave me something that day. That meant a lot. Here was a man who overcame something of the assault on his manhood. Why? Because he made a choice to create in chaos and to move toward a woman when he didn't have a clue what to do. All he knew was he jolly well better move. Because, why? He got his eyes off his wound and onto his wife's need. Where are your eyes? One more illustration. The assaults of manhood that take that tendency we inherited from Adam to not speak without a code and convince us that it's very reasonable. What's your symbol event? Let me give you a symbol event for me. It may not be the biggest one, but it's one that comes to mind as I ponder this. Frankly, it's embarrassing to tell, but let me tell it. When I was about 8 years old, my parents and I were visiting with family friends, good friends of mother and dad. Bob and Alice McCoy were the names. I was about 7, 8 maybe. And they had a daughter named Nancy who was my age. I thought she was cute. I was kind of precocious. And while the family was together, we had dinner together, and then Mom and Dad and their friends were chatting somewhere in the living room. And Nancy and I, we were the playmates for the evening. Nancy and I went up to her bedroom to play games, to read comics, to do something. And I decided that I wanted to kiss Nancy. So I kind of made my move. And I went over and kind of, you know, whatever you do that's 8 that feels macho, you know, something. You know, spit in the floor or something to let her know you're really a man. And I went over and I was going to kiss her. And she discerned my intentions. And she screamed. Her dad heard the scream, came to the bottom of the stairs, called up, What are you guys doing up there? You know what I did? I grabbed for a comic book, picked it up, opened it, and said, we're just reading comics. And I heard him and his wife laugh. Notice three things in that story. Notice, first of all, that I assertively moved toward a girl with natural urges, wrongly. I'm not saying that was a good thing for me to have done, but I moved toward her insensitively, wrongly, unkindly, inappropriately, but I moved. Something inside of me went, yeah. Notice that, first of all. Notice, secondly, that when confronted, I didn't say a word until I had grabbed a comic book. Notice that? Isn't that curious? I think that's because I wanted to be able to truthfully say we're just reading comics. Been raised in a very strong Christian home. I was conscious of returning to a code very quickly and living by it. Don't lie. But you're in trouble. You get right back to doing what's right. And do it this minute. Live by code. Don't you do it. Anything is wrong. Tell the truth. That's supposed to work. The third thing in the story is I heard them laugh. And I can recall internally feeling a level of shame that gripped my soul. When it was time to go that evening, I don't want to come down the stairs. Just didn't want to do it. What did I learn from that? Call that an experience that assaulted my manhood. Call that an experience that taught me something that comes naturally to me anyhow as Adam's son. And put my inherited tendency as a member of the human race who's male along with these assaults on my manhood, and you end up with a problem. And the problem, I think, is something like this. Don't release who you are, you'll get in trouble. And even when you recover from an error, by living by the code, you're still going to get no respect. You know, one of my big struggles is I keep waiting to be found out. Anybody feel like that? Keep waiting to be found out. I've often thought, be nice, write a book someday and have the book called What I Really Want to Say, and tell the publisher, publish it after I die. You ever feel like that? What do you really want to say? Well, for goodness sakes, don't do it. What do you really want to be? I mean good things now. I don't mean grabbing little girls and kissing them. I mean moving into your worlds on behalf of God, moving into people's lives because you care, talking to your son, talking to your daughter, talking to your wife, talking to your world. Moving into your world saying, I'm not sure what to do, within moral limits, here's who I am and I'm going to come. That's a sexual phrase, isn't it? I'm going to come. I've prayed the last 6 months, I think my single biggest prayer in terms of me has been, Lord, I want release. I want to come. Living in the fear of doing it right. Am I living by the code? Am I handling things the way I want to handle them? A friend of mine 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, pastor, had a father who abandoned the family when the little boy was about five. The little boy grew up, became quite an athlete, was a major football star at a major university. His dad got back involved in his life. Called him up in his senior year of college. He'd been turning into a pretty good player. His senior year, he became an outstanding player. He was on national TV. And his dad watched his son on national TV and gave him a call. Hadn't talked to his son in years. And said, I'd like to, your birthday is coming up, 21st birthday, next Friday night. How about if we have dinner next Friday night together? Hadn't seen his dad for years. The 20-year-old boy's young man's heart was just thumping with excitement. Wednesday night, he was in his college dorm. The chaplain knocked on the door and said to him, I have difficult news for you. Your father has just been shot in a poker game. He's dead. What's the message to that gentleman? Don't hope. Don't ever hope. Work hard, but don't expect much. And when bad things come, realize that's the way it is. Life never works. When there are problems in this man's family, his response is it'll all probably fall apart. I'll do my best, but I know it's not going to work out well. I have no zeal, no joy, no hope. I'm frantic. I work hard, but I'm just putting off the inevitable. Whenever anything looks good, it's going to be taken from me. I know that. So I'll just do whatever I should. I'll play by the book. And he's a pastor by the book up until a little while ago. He's learning to be a pastor a little bit by the Spirit, and it's very different. What's our problem? Well, something's wrong. We live by code, not courage. What's missing? Fatherhood. Nobody believes in us. Brotherhood. Nobody's listening. What are the effects? We lose courage and look for something that we can make work. We look for somebody who cares. Depending how well it all goes, we live as comfortable men who are passionless, troubled men who are apprehensive, dysfunctional men who are stubborn, and unhealthily connected men who are self-focused and can't see beyond our own souls. How'd the problem start? With Adam's silence, when there was no code. And our silence has been shaped by symbol events that have assaulted our manhood. The last question for the day, what do we do about it? We'll look at it after we break.